Today on Maine Calling, Barbara Walters, Rule Breaker. Broadcast journalist Barbara Walters commands a firm place in American culture. Her style has been widely imitated and was parodied for decades. One might take Walters for granted, but Barbara Walters was never handed her fame. She fought hard against overt sexism and for every big name interview. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, our guest, USA Today journalist Susan Page, is the author of a new biography about Barbara Walters. Her book reveals a complicated and vulnerable trailblazer. It's hard to overstate the impact Barbara Walters had on the field of broadcast journalism, especially for the women journalists who came after her. But at what price? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Looking at today's journalism landscape, it may be difficult to believe that not too long ago, it was rare to see or hear a woman journalist covering national news. Barbara Walters changed all of that. My guest today is Susan Page, who is the author of The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters. Susan has written best-selling biographies of Barbara Bush and Nancy Pelosi. She is the Washington Bureau Chief at USA Today. Of course, we invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about Barbara Walters? What do you want to know about, or what do you remember about her and think her legacy is? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or find us on social media. Susan Page, welcome back to Maine Calling, and congratulations on your new book. It is really a page-turner.
Jen, thank you so much. It's so good to be back on your show.
You know, it's so interesting to me because Barbara Walters lived her life so publicly, and she's somebody who we think we knew, but we really didn't, did we?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we knew about her career because, as you say, that was in front of us every night, every week on the TV. But I think we didn't know much about, number one, what kind of drove her to make her succeed in roles that no woman had ever succeeded in before, and also about what price she paid in her personal life for that ambition.
I'm wondering, you've already written books, as I just mentioned, on Nancy Pelosi and Barbara Bush. What made you decide to write a book about Barbara Walters? Was it a conversation you had? Did you meet her? What was the spark that of all the possible people to profile next, to write a biography of, it was going to be Barbara Walters?
You know, Jen, I didn't start out with any kind of master plan when I started to kind of write books on the side. I wrote the biography of Barbara Bush, of course, who loved Maine. I'm sure she was a regular listener to your station. I did it because I covered her in politics, her husband's campaigns and her son's campaigns. And I thought, here's a woman who's consequential in ways people don't know and who is not the person people think she was. People thought she was a grandmother who booked cookies. That could not describe Barbara Bush, who was really tough-minded, had a spine of steel. And I thought she ought to be recognized for what she was. You know, Nancy Pelosi, it was another groundbreaking woman, the most powerful woman in the history of the American government. And again, I thought she had no good biography of hers. And I thought that she would be interesting to explore. So then I thought I'd like to do a third book. And I've kind of gotten in the habit of doing women. And I think, you know, statistically, this will not surprise you, Jen, that women are less likely to have biographies written about them than men, even when they live similar lives. So I was looking around for a woman who had an impact and maybe we didn't fully understand. And that's where Barbara Walters came in.
Did you ever meet her?
I never met her, and her health was failing when I started the book, started researching the book. So I went into doing the book knowing that I would not be able to interview her, but she knew I was doing the book, and she was helpful in this way. When friends would call her and say, "This woman has called me and says she's writing a biography of you," Barbara would not say, "Don't talk to her." She would say, "You can decide if you want to talk to her or not." And that gave permission for some of her very close friends to talk to me when I'm sure they would not have done that if she had said, "Don't talk to her."
Well, let's start at the beginning. I don't think many people quite realize that Barbara Walters' father was in showbiz. So there was it was a very different kind of showbiz than what she ended up in, but there was something that she learned, a lot of things that she learned and took with her throughout her career from her father's experience. For those who don't know about this, and that's probably most of us who are under the age of 80, tell us about Barbara Walters' father.
Lew Walters, he was one of the great impresarios of his time. He started out as a vaudeville booker, a booker for vaudeville acts, and then he became a creator of nightclubs, the Latin Quarter, which he created first in Boston and then in Miami and finally in New York, was one of the most famous nightclubs in America, one of the biggest tourist attractions in New York. He had the gift of understanding his audience. So he understood what an audience would be interested in seeing. And that was part of his gift to his daughter, that she had an exquisite sense of what was going to be draw eyeballs to her TV shows. But he left her another legacy too. He would be hugely successful. He would be a millionaire, and they would live in a penthouse with a view of Central Park. And then he would gamble it all away. And then he would squander it in investments on Broadway and other enterprises that failed, and they would be nearly bankrupt. And this happened not once. This happened over and over again during her childhood. And you can imagine what that did to a child. It meant that Barbara Walters, to the end of her life, worried that all her fame and all her fortune could disappear with a misstep, because that's what had happened when she was growing up.
And she felt very responsible for her family from a very early age. I'm going to read just a line you wrote on page 67. You wrote, "She would always feel that calamity lurked just around the corner and that it was up to her to prevent it."
Now, what a burden for a child, right? And this came into high relief when she was 28 years old. She was not the Barbara Walters we think of. She was not employed. She had just gotten divorced. In fact, she had flown to Alabama to get a quickie divorce from her first husband, a marriage she then conveniently forgot she had ever had. So she was crashing with a school friend of hers in their apartment, her friend's apartment, in New York, when her mother called and said, "Your father has taken all his pills." Her father had attempted suicide. And it tells you something about the family dynamic that her mother didn't call an ambulance. Her mother called Barbara. Barbara ran over to the hotel where they were staying in New York. Barbara called the ambulance. And when the ambulance came, it was Barbara who rode in the back of the ambulance with her father to the hospital. And she said later that she knew at that instant that it was now going to be up to her to support her suicidal father, her unhappy mother, and her disabled sister. And that was when Barbara Walters became the relentless, driving, successful Barbara Walters that we think of today.
I think many of us in broadcast journalism, many women in broadcast journalism, have a vague idea that we are here, that we had opportunity thanks to people like Barbara Walters and especially Barbara Walters. But Susan, it wasn't until reading this book that I sort of came face to face with the shocking sexism she faced and the mean-spiritedness. And I'm wondering if there are a couple stories that you feel as though are the most emblematic of that.
Well, she got her first job as a writer for a CBS show, a CBS news show, because the man who hired her said she had the cutest ass. And that was the qualification that got her that first job. She worked and worked and worked. She got a job as the girl writer for NBC's Today Show. The girl writer, they had one woman on the writing staff who would write for women who were going to be on the air, because God knows a woman couldn't possibly write for a man who was going to be on the air. And she worked relentlessly to get herself an on-the-air job. And she eventually got that. Then Frank McGee became the host of NBC's Today Show, and he had utter contempt for Barbara Walters. And he set a rule that the head of the network agreed to, that Barbara Walters had, that he got to ask the first three questions in an interview, and only then was Barbara Walters allowed to speak. Now, can you imagine silencing Barbara Walters that way as she sits with you next to you on the set? Then she gets her biggest, the promotion she had wanted so much. She got promoted, $1 million salary to co-host the ABC Evening News with Harry Reasoner. Now, Harry Reasoner threatened to quit when he heard they were going to hire her as his partner on the air. And he only didn't quit when they gave him a bunch more money to get closer to Barbara Walters' groundbreaking salary of $1 million a year. But he created what today we would call a hostile workplace for her. He turned the crew against her. She would find herself crying in her room, in her office, because of all the grief she was taking from almost everyone else who worked there. That was the point where she thought maybe she had gone too far. Maybe she had repeated her father's mistake, had too much ambition, taken an unwise step for a bigger job, and now was failing at it. And after that, she started a comeback that really defined her as the best interviewer on TV.
And members of the public were downright mean. I mean, famously, those of us of a certain age remember Saturday Night Live and Barbara Wawa. I mean, as the nation was laughing at her, she wasn't laughing.
You know, it's amazing that someone who could be so successful in broadcasting had a speech anomaly. She told people it was a Boston accent. Nobody else from Boston had this accent. She had, it was a kind of a lisp. She couldn't say R's. And that was the gag that Saturday Night Live did first with Gilda Radner in the Baba Wawa thing. And you know, initially, the first time they started to air those skits, her feelings were hurt. You know, she had this speech anomaly that she'd gone to speech coaches to try to fix. They'd been unable to do much about it. And it hurt her feelings. But then Bette Davis offered her some advice. She was interviewing Bette Davis near the end of Bette Davis's life. And Bette Davis said, "No, you know what? This is a good thing for you. What you need to have is some signature that people recognize." And for Bette Davis, that had been a line in a movie where she had said, "What a dump." And that became Bette Davis's signature. And Bette Davis told Barbara Walters, "This is how you get to be a legend." And then Barbara Walters felt all right about it.
And she got a very important message from actor John Wayne, right?
He sent her, she didn't know John Wayne. But when she was being basically harassed on the air by Harry Reasoner, John Wayne sent her a note saying, not to let, basically, don't let him get you down. So that was quite remarkable. The Harry Reasoner's contempt was so apparent that they stopped doing what they called two shots on the evening news. That's where you would see Barbara Walters talking, but you would see Harry Reasoner listening to her. But he would often be scowling at her. And so they just stopped doing two shots on the air because of that.
Well, Barbara Walters is famous for getting the big get, getting the big interview. I knew I had read, Susan, that these big anchors did things that I've never done, like send flowers to potential interviewees or try to get close to their families or things like that. But she really went to extraordinary lengths to get an interview. And I'm wondering if you can retell the story about Anwar Sadat and Walter Cronkite.
So, you know, Cronkite, the most famous journalist in America, was one of those who didn't think Barbara Walters was a real journalist. She was a celebrity interviewer. And Walter Cronkite had gotten an early beat of broken an important story that Anwar Sadat, the leader of Egypt, was going to go to Israel. This was really quite a groundbreaking moment. But it was it was Barbara Walters who then scrambled to Walter Cronkite's ultimate dismay and ended up landing the first interview with the two men sitting together, the leaders of Egypt and Israel. This was a scoop that delighted Barbara in particular for two reasons. One, she was scooping Walter Cronkite. And number two, it made it very hard for those who disapproved of her to say she wasn't a real journalist. Now, when Walter Cronkite heard she had gotten this interview, he hurriedly arranged his own joint interview. And when the interview ended, you could hear him on the tape that was then sent to New York saying, "Did Barbara get anything I didn't?"
Now, maybe I'm transposing stories. Which is the one that involved the running across the tarmac to
This was during this story. So Walter Cronkite had also managed to get himself on Sadat's plane that would fly to Israel. And Barbara Walters didn't realize that was a possibility. She had gone directly to Israel. So when actually Rune Arledge in New York heard that Cronkite had gotten on the plane, he woke Barbara up at her hotel in Israel, and they then chartered a French jet to take her to Cyprus and then to Egypt, because in those days you couldn't fly directly. It was forbidden to fly directly from Israel to Egypt. And Barbara Walters had so much pull that Israel and Egypt agreed she could skip the Cyprus stop. So she became the first person since 1948 to go directly from Israel to Egypt on a civilian plane. She lands at the airport. Walter Cronkite is sitting, feeling pretty good about himself on Sadat's plane when he sees this French jet land and Barbara Walters pop out and come running across the tarmac to the Anwar Sadat's plane. He was not pleased.
I love that. I love that image. So much more to talk about. We're talking with Susan Page about her new biography, The Rule Breaker, about Barbara Walters. What are your questions for her? And what do you think is so important about Barbara Walters' life? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or find us on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking about one of the giants in broadcast journalism, Barbara Walters. My guest, Susan Page, who is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today and who has written a number of best-selling biographies. Her latest book, The Rule Breaker: The Life and Times of Barbara Walters. Join the conversation. Send us an email, talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Susan Page, you talk a great deal in the book. You write a great deal about Barbara Walters' personal life. You did mention that she had a first wedding that she never talked about again, a first marriage, but that was not her only marriage. And why don't you tell us a little bit about her husbands?
So their first husband, the one she forgot, was the good-looking, highly educated son of a guy who manufactured baby bonnets. And the son was taking over the baby bonnet business at the time they got married. That lasted about 3 years, that marriage. They got divorced. Then she married Lee Goober, who was also kind of in show business. He did theatrical productions, initially under tents on the East Coast, some famous ones, successful at that, then tried to get moved to Broadway, less successful than that. And with Lee Goober, the marriage didn't last, but together they adopted a daughter, Barbara Walters' only daughter. And after their divorce, she married Merv Adelson, who was a Hollywood producer of some big TV soaps like Dallas and Knots Landing. And that marriage also lasted a couple years before they got divorced. You know, her longest relationship with a man, longer than her three marriages put together, was with Roy Cohn, the notorious lawyer and fixer in New York, who had worked for McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings, became a lawyer for Trump later in life. And they had the most remarkable relationship, and one that she talked about less than her marriages, but was really in some ways more important. They met when she was 25. Through the years, he repeatedly proposed marriage to her, although he was a closeted gay man, something that she didn't realize at the time, became clear only later. He helped her out when she got in trouble. When her father got faced an arrest warrant because of a case involving not paying taxes in New York, Roy Cohn made it disappear. And when Barbara Walters wanted to adopt a child, Ray Cohn arranged the help facilitated the private adoption of her daughter. And most interestingly of all, I think Barbara Walters said her true love of her life, the true love of her life, was Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts. And this was an affair conducted in some secrecy because Senator Brooke was married at the time. He was also a black man. That would have been controversial at the time for Barbara Walters. And it was Roy Cohn who said, "This will hurt your career if this becomes known." So at the point Senator Brooke was willing to leave his wife to marry Barbara Walters, she broke it off because she feared what it would do to her career.
It seems so sad. And then later on, when you talk about her relationship with Diane Sawyer, it was one of the things she envied, that Diane Sawyer had a happy marriage.
Yes, it was Diane Sawyer who talked to me for the book, said Barbara was wistful about the idea that she had never had the kind of sustained happy marriage that Diane Sawyer had with Mike Nichols.
Tell us about Barbara Walters' daughter. She had a connection to Maine, didn't she?
She did. After she graduated, she had a long struggle with substance abuse. She ended up going to high school in Idaho at a ranch for kids who were having struggles of various kinds. She stayed on the West Coast, but she eventually in 2001 moved to Maine near Springfield and opened a sort of outdoor facility for girls who were having problems. She called it New Horizons for New Women. And it was for teenage girls or maybe somewhere in their early 20s who were having the same kind of struggle she had had as a younger woman. And this camp operated for 7 years before it closed. And at that point, she moved to Florida.
What was Barbara Walters' relationship with her daughter like?
Well, she adored having a daughter, but she didn't adore some of the tasks that are connected with successful parenting, in that she wanted to have a daughter, but she didn't want it to interrupt in any way her career. They were estranged for a time. They were so different. Her daughter, as you can imagine, for moving to Springfield, Maine, was loved the outdoors, liked to camp, wore fleece and flannel. And Barbara Walters loved the city and society parties and designer gowns. So in that way, they seemed to never be a good fit. They did reconcile later in life, but it was an up and it was at times a difficult relationship.
You know, we've talked about how Barbara Walters liked to get the big get, and I want to return to another story about that. But I also need to diverge because the show that she created is still on the air, The View. You know, it's so funny, Susan, when you have things that are just around and are there every day, you might not think about how revolutionary they were in the first place, especially a show that's a group of people talking for an hour, but The View was really revolutionary and it was completely Barbara Walters' idea, correct?
Yeah, you know, when I talk to older people about Barbara Walters, they remember the ABC Evening News and Harry Reisner, maybe the Monica Lewinsky interview. When I talk to younger people, they think of her in connection with The View. And here's what's remarkable. She was 67 years old when she and Bill Getty, her producer, proposed the idea of The View. And you're quite right. It was something that had not really been done before. It was a new form of talk TV, which everyone has copied, so there are lots of View-like shows on the air now, but there weren't before The View was there. The idea was women of different generations and different perspectives, a diverse group of women sitting around gabbing. And it turned out to be, and I'll tell you, ABC was not sure it was going to succeed. And the way that Barbara Walters knew ABC wasn't sure it was going to succeed was that they wouldn't let them buy a new set. They wouldn't invest in a new set for the show. They had to use a leftover set from a soap opera, a daytime soap opera that had just been canceled. So how wrong were they in that a quarter century later, The View is still on the air. It gets a big audience. It still can create controversy. And it became the first show that a sitting pre the first daytime show that a sitting president ever went on to appear, which was Barack Obama.
You mentioned the Monica Lewinsky interview. You dedicate a chapter in your book to that. Especially interesting now that Monica Lewinsky has done sort of another, has been back in the news recently. And we look at her from a completely different perspective after Me Too. But tell us about that. How did Barbara Walters get that interview? And how did she feel about it afterwards?
This, you talked earlier about the efforts that went into getting a big interview. And of course, Monica Lewinsky, that was an interview everybody in television wanted to get. Diane Sawyer and Oprah Winfrey and Connie Chung and Katie Couric all were scrambling to try to get the first interview with Monica Lewinsky. For Barbara Walters, it took more than a year of effort to get it. And she started by like she always did. She cultivated Monica's first lawyer, and then she talked to Monica's father, and she talked to Monica's mother, and then she talked to Monica's second set of lawyers. And finally, she got to meet Monica off the record for lunch at her apartment. And she made the case to Monica Lewinsky that doing the that number one, she treated Monica Lewinsky with respect. And she made the case that if Monica Lewinsky wanted to introduce herself to Americans as someone other than this kind of cartoonish figure that Americans had seen to date, that Barbara Walters was the person with the credibility to make that happen, to do a serious interview, not a softball interview, but also not a hostile one. And Monica Lewinsky, after incredible machinations, legal and otherwise, finally agreed. And this interview was a master class in interviewing a public figure about some issues, including about some issues that are sensitive. It also got the biggest ratings in the history of television for an interview on a single network before or since.
I want to fast forward to the end of her life, Susan Page. I think that most of us, well, I'll tell you something. When I told a few people about your biography, people said, "Oh, is Barbara Walters still alive?" People don't even know that she has died. And so tell us about the end of her life.
So she died on December 30th, 2022, which was a for her from her point of view, I think it would have been a very unfortunate time to die because it's the day before New Year's Eve, and no one is watching television news at that moment. The main anchors are not on the air on the night she died. It was a time when people's attention was entirely elsewhere. And then Pope Benedict died the next day. So he took a lot of the obituary thunder away from her. So she didn't get the send-off that I think she would have liked to have had. She had her final years were so difficult. She was suffering, I discovered in doing research, from a condition called encephalitis. Some people call it water on the brain. She had fallen at the British Embassy in on the marble stairs in January of 2013. That trauma contributed to a decline both in her physical mobility and in her mental acuity. So she had her final years were one when when her world just contracted, and she had lived in such a big world. She loved being in the middle of the news, in the middle of the conversation, in the best table at the biggest dinners. And that just ended because she was unwilling to be seen in a diminished state. She didn't want anyone to see her in the wheelchair that she eventually used. And so she spent those final years almost alone in her fabulous Fifth Avenue apartment.
One of the things that was saddest to me reading this, Susan, is that she really didn't seem to have an opportunity to celebrate herself, to appreciate what she had done. In fact, it seems from reading your biography that she was filled with grievances until the very end.
Yeah, she had grievances, particularly against Diane Sawyer, who she saw as a great rival. She had some resentment of the women who followed her in TV broadcasting because they had an easier time than she had, in part because of her. And, you know, in many ways, she never felt content. It was never enough, not all the accolades and all the money that she got. And, you know, I think there's a sense among some groundbreakers that you're not breaking ground for all the people who follow you. You're breaking ground for yourself. And so you don't even, it's not so you become some icon for women in broadcasting that you're doing this. You're doing this because you want to succeed in this. So it makes you less than generous to the women who are behind you or around you. And I think that was the case with Barbara Walters. It's, you know, it reflects a time when there might be one role for a woman on a show, but there weren't going to be roles for two women on a show. It was a zero-sum game. So if Diane Sawyer got something you wanted, it was gone. It was hers. It wouldn't be yours. And I think that was a sense that Barbara Walters never left. The one exception might be this the last big show she did on The View, where they arranged for two dozen of the most accomplished women in television news to come on stage and stand around her and thank her. And that gave her a lot of pleasure. But Jen, when I ask the people I interviewed, was Barbara Walters happy? You could count on the fingers on one hand the number of people who said, yes, she was happy. Almost everyone said, well, she was pleased with her success. She delighted in all she had done, but happy? No.
I'll go to a couple questions coming in. This one from Katie. Let's see. How did people like Harry Reasoner feel? How people like Harry Reasoner didn't feel Barbara Walters had the journalism chops. So can you talk about what kind of experience or training she did have in journalism?
She didn't have a traditional journalistic career. You know, she had come from she had grown up in the world of nightclubs. She didn't go to journalism school. She went to Sarah Lawrence. With a degree and not anything in particular. She was drawn to TV news because she saw the parallels with the things she had learned from her dad's experience in entertainment. So she definitely blurred the line between entertainment and news. But those who say she wasn't really a journalist, I say, look at the interviews she did with some of the most powerful people in the world. And you know, Jen, the interview that struck me most was not her most famous one, which is probably Monica or Sadat and Begin. The interview that blew me away was one she did when she was 82 years old with Bashar al-Assad in Syria at the time of the Arab Spring. And that interview was tough and even dangerous and fearless and remarkable.
Well, and you know, you said she didn't go to journalism school, but most of those guys didn't, right? I mean, I don't think Peter Jennings even finished high school.
No, he finished high school. He didn't finish college.
Okay, yeah.
But you know, what most of those guys had done was work for local newspapers. Some of them had worked for Edward R. Murrow during World War II and radio. So they had a grounding in journalism that she didn't have. She went from writer at the Today Show to an on-air job at the Today Show to co-host at the Today Show to co-host of the Evening News to 2020 and all those specials that we remember.
But she was getting her education on the job.
She got an education. She gave people an education on the job.
We are speaking with Susan Page about her new biography of Barbara Walters. What are your questions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a quick email, talk@mainepublic.org, or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Joining me today, Susan Page, an award-winning journalist with USA Today. We are talking about her new biography of Barbara Walters, and the title of the book is The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Susan, you call the book The Rule Breaker, and I want to have you tell a story about, a kind of famous story about a big rule, a big instance of this that happened at Camp David.
I mean, this wasn't a rule. This was probably a law. So, you know, during the Camp David summit in the Carter administration, and there were a bunch of reporters who were cooling their heels down in Thurmont, Maryland, which is where the press would be kept, because of course they weren't allowed to go to Camp David. But there was one photo op they brought the press up in two buses to come up and see while this summit was going on. Barbara Walters was among them. She was on one of the buses. So they see this kind of a dog and pony show, and they're told to reload back up on the buses, and everybody does, except when the security people count the reporters on the buses, and there were supposed to be 50 of them, there were only 49. Who was missing? Barbara Walters. So one of the White House folks went to Sam Donaldson, who worked with Barbara at ABC, and said, "Sam, where is Barbara?" And he said, "Am I my sister's keeper?" And I think that Sam actually had no idea where Barbara was. Finally, they found her hiding in the stall of a restroom. And her plan had been the buses would go away, she would slip out and somehow manage to get an interview with the participants at Camp David on her own. Now, Camp David is one of the most highly guarded places in America, probably in the world. So the idea that she could get away with this is extraordinary. They find her, they order her back on the bus. You know what she didn't do? She did not apologize.
Well, I'm wondering, too, I mean, obviously the chutzpah, but she didn't have a photographer with her. How is she going to? I don't even quite understand what the fully fleshed out plan is. But I wanted to ask you, Susan, as somebody who has been, you know, in the White House press corps and has been a part of those groups that has been ushered along. Can you even imagine?
No. If for some of us, we'd be arrested if we tried that. What if she had succeeded? She could have been shot. You know, I don't think, Jen, she had a fully fleshed out plan in mind. I think she thought, okay, here's an opportunity. Just like I was running across the tarmac in Cairo, why don't I go hide in the restroom and see what happens next?
We'll go to Dan, who's calling from Brewer. Hi, Dan, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I was just calling to let you know that I had an interview with Barbara Walters back in 2001 on 2020. I own the world's first guide horse for the blind. She's only 2 feet tall. And after we did the interview, she started talking to me about other things, how she had a sister in Orland, Maine, that she would come up and visit and help take care of her a lot. And she was hoping that maybe someday she'd be able to pop in to say hello. I met her and Connie Chung up at the TV studio, and they're wonderful. She was such a wonderful person, and she gave me the opinion that she was so strong in her heart. She wasn't going to let nothing get in her way.
Dan, I'm so glad you called. And did you feel like when you watched the interview on television, did you feel like Barbara Walters had represented you well?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. She just put me at comfort. Even before the interview, she told me not to worry, just talk to her like, you know, like she was a normal person. And I said, that's pretty hard to do. You're so famous. But I really enjoyed her company. I enjoyed the interview. I thought she was a wonderful lady. And just knowing that she was taking care of her sister up there in Maine, which wasn't far from where I lived at the time. But, yeah, I just wanted to say God bless her, and she's a beautiful woman.
Well, Susan, I'm sure you're thrilled with Dan's story.
Yeah, you and Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin and Monica Lewinsky, all in the same group, people who have been interviewed by Barbara Walters. I think one of her strengths as an interviewer was that she connected with the person she was interviewing. She made them feel she made them feel like they could talk in a spontaneous and honest way. And one of the things that happened, and I bet it didn't happen for Dan, was she often made people cry. I don't think she'd set out to make people cry, but there was case after case where she would ask a question and people would tear up. Even Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf, the general, started crying during his interview with Barbara Walters. And she said the question most likely to get somebody to cry was, "Tell me about your father." So she often asked that question. That was a question, in fact, she had asked Schwarzkopf when he began to cry. And it strikes me that that was, if you wanted to make Barbara Walters cry, that might well be the question you would ask.
Dan, thank you so much for calling in and telling us about that recollection. We'll go to Westbrook and Mike. Hi, Mike, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I'm wondering about Barbara Walters' sense of humor, and I'm thinking in particular about the parodies that Gilda Radner did. Baba Wawa.
Yeah, so, Susan, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the program, and you talked about the advice from Bette Davis, but also her daughter gave her some advice too, right?
Yeah, when she first saw this and she was a little taken aback by the caricature, her daughter said, "Come on, chill, basically. It's funny." And so even though it wounded her a little, I think she loved being the center of attention. She had a sense of humor, but she also had such a drive that when her sense of humor and her drive were in conflict, you can pretty much guarantee she would go with the drive.
Do you have any, did you hear any stories about the sense of humor? Did she play practical jokes on people or tell jokes? What was it like?
No, I don't think there were practical jokes. That would have been great, right? Barbara Walters' favorite practical jokes. I would like to have seen that. Here's what something she loved to do on The View that she had never been able to do earlier in her career. She liked to show kind of her personal side on The View, of her personality. On The View, they would talk about sex. She never talked about sex on 2020, not sex for herself. She loved to come in costumes on Halloween on the set of The View. And there was one year she came as Marilyn Monroe and refused to drop the kind of caricature she was doing of Marilyn Monroe for the whole show, to the consternation of the other women around the table.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for your good question. Here's an email from John. Who did Walters think was her greatest get? Did she have a favorite interviewer or interviewee?
So I think two. I think Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin was a very important and very serious interview for her, and a real achievement. And I think Monica Lewinsky would be the other one because it got such a huge audience. More than 70 million Americans watched all or part of that interview. That is an extraordinary number.
And that leads to a big question I have for you, Susan. And nobody, no television show gets 70 million viewers anymore between cable television and all the streaming channels. And it may even be hard for young people listening right now to get their head around what it was like to have four networks and appointment television that the entire nation watched together. But here we are today. There are women journalists on television everywhere. Social media is something that many people get their news from instead of television, radio, or newspapers. What do you think about Barbara Walters' legacy now? What is her lasting legacy, and what will kind of be lost in the wind?
I think you cannot understate her legacy for women. And that is true for women in broadcasting who followed. It's true for women in journalism generally. I think it is true for girls who grew up and wanted to be doctors or lawyers or astronauts, that they could see Barbara Walters up there as an often as a singular, the singular female character who was grilling male newsmakers, who was asking tough questions, who was earning big salaries. And it made, I think it for a generation or two of women, it made a difference to see her in that role. And I know that's true for me. You know, it never occurred to me that women couldn't interview people or women couldn't be a journalist. And of course, I'm a print journalist, not a broadcast journalist. But Barbara Walters was part of changing the mindset about who might be able to do some of these big and important jobs. I think that's a very important legacy. She was a big innovator when it comes to broadcast television. She did blur the line between entertainment and news. She made interviews with celebrities and actors and notorious murderers part of our conversation. She opened the conversation to more personal topics than had previously been dealt with in TV interviews. And then there's The View. So she has a legacy both as a woman and as a journalist that has not been erased by changes in our technology.
Did you realize all of that before you went into this project? Or was it in writing and doing the research that you sort of had this profound realization that she was so important on so many levels?
I definitely evolved as I was doing research. I mean, doing a biography, it's a leap of faith, right? You assume somebody will turn out to be interesting and important. You certainly hope they will. And Barbara Walters certainly turned out to be a complicated and consequential person with a life to explore.
Is there any interview that she never got that she always wanted to?
Yes, the Pope. And now Nora O'Donnell got an interview with, I mean, any Pope, right? She wanted to interview the Pope. She did interview the Dalai Lama. The Pope, she never landed. I think she would have hope she would have thought it was sweet, like a good thing that a woman who anchors the CBS Evening News landed this interview that she had so long sought.
Let's see. We have just a couple minutes. I want to go to this email from Alex. What did her female journalist peers think of Barbara Walters? Did they respect her, envy her, or compete with her? Early on, she didn't have any peers really, right?
You know, Alex, she did all those things, right? I mean, they did all those things. They respected her, acknowledged her achievements. They competed with her fiercely. You know, not just Diane Sawyer, but Katie Couric and Connie Chung. And everybody else who was trying to succeed and get the biggest interviews on television, they admired her. But, you know, they also, I think some of the women who followed her took a lesson from her personal experiences that you need to, like, have some kind of work-life balance if you're going to have a three-dimensional life that will give you satisfaction to the end.
All right. We'll try to squeeze in one more call. We'll go to Arthur in Westbrook. Arthur, if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Sure. I'd like to see if you could comment on her interview with Mimi Alford, which was one of JFK's mistresses. Apparently, she chastised her on air for coming forward with her story.
Arthur, I don't know that interview. So you've stumped the author here.
Ah, but does it surprise you that she chastised her on air?
Well, she could do that. I mean, that's one of those things that Barbara Walters might do that most journalists wouldn't have done. But, you know, that was Barbara Walters. She was pretty fearless.
Arthur, thanks for your call. Susan, we have 1 minute left, so I have to ask you, who's your next biography subject?
So, Jen, let me ask you, who should my next subject be?
I don't know. I mean, it's got to be a woman, obviously.
Well, it doesn't have to be a woman, although I do think women are both interesting and underappreciated, and that makes them good subjects.
Do you have a running list, or are you just asking everyone you know?
I'm asking everyone I know. We should ask your audience to send in their suggestions for somebody they would like to read a biography of.
Well, so we're at the end of the program. They can't do it right now. I suppose you can go to the talk@mainpublic.org inbox. And if you have a suggestion for Susan Page, we promise to forward it to her. How does that sound?
That sounds great. Thanks, everybody, for your good ideas.
Well, thank you so much, Susan, for a great conversation today. Susan Page is the author of the brand new biography of Barbara Walters called The Rule Breaker. Today's sound engineer, Sam Tracy, our theme music composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling was produced, of course, by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or to listen to past programs. That's mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.